So welcome to the Relativity Core course. So the subject of this will be mainly general relativity, but today I will actually review some parts of special relativity which will be needed later. And so hopefully that will also give you some slightly different perspective on what is important about special relativity and what is not. Because typically people start discussing special relativity with Lorentz transformations, and then it's not really clear that how different this is from Newtonian physics. So anyway, so the objective of the course is general relativity. It's slightly more difficult than special relativity. And this is reflected by the very fact that it took Einstein a couple of months to figure out special relativity, whereas it took him 10 years to actually discover or fully formulate general relativity. So basically he started working on it immediately after special relativity, so in 1905, and then he finally published his field equations in 1915, so really 10 years. All right, so the preliminary course outline. So today is the special relativity, and then tomorrow hopefully we will start like a conceptual path towards general relativity. And so I will try to, you know, basically do general relativity without differential geometry, and let's see how far we can go. So basically the idea would be to use Einstein's principle of equivalence and his ingenious idea of Einstein's elevator. And then we shall see that we can go pretty far with that idea. Okay, so that's the first look at GR. Then, however, we cannot really formulate the field equations starting with just principle of equivalence. And that's why we will have to do some geometric tools. So we will study some differential geometry. I will tell you what a manifold is. And I will tell you, you know, everything you need to know about metrics and you know, curvatures and stuff like that. And then we will proceed to general relativity, and I will try to use the Lagrangian approach to general relativity. So we'll basically discuss the Einstein-Hilbert action from where the Einstein equations follow and so on. So that's the plan. In the end, if we still have some time, I would like to mention some advanced topics. So we certainly will discuss gravitational waves. We will discuss a little bit about black holes. And a little bit about observational aspects of general relativity. But if time permits, maybe I will also discuss black hole thermodynamics, or maybe I will discuss about rotating black holes or something like that. So there's this list of some advanced topics, but I will probably only cover one or two. I got really excited about strong and weak cosmic censorships recently, because that's where actually the most progress has been done in the last couple of years. So maybe I will just mention what strong and weak cosmic censorships are, if time permits. Anyway, so additional reading. So there is already the PSI study text. I just uploaded it on the wiki, so you can actually follow the lecture notes there. It will probably be, you know, there will be some changes to what I actually will lecture. But I will update the study text afterwards. So now there are excellent books available for general relativity. So the book which is, I think, most appropriate for this course is Sean Carroll's Spacetime and Geometry. And that basically it's you know, super nice to read. You can read it before you go to bed. It's really nicely written. And it discusses all the topics we will cover here and much more. So I think it's a really, really nice book. If you are more old-fashioned, you can go to Landau and Lifshitz, and basically general relativity is discussed there in 100 pages. So all you need to know about general relativity, again, it's scattered in this. It's like the last fifth of the book, the classical theory of fields. So if you just read the last couple of chapters in that book, that's all you need to know about gravitational physics. Then there are more modern books like Zeiss, Einstein's Gravity in a Nutshell. Nice book is Hartle's one, which actually has the experimental approach. So basically, it always discusses an experiment, and then it sort of, you know, try to explain what I need to do to actually to understand this experiment. What theory do I need to develop, and so on. So it's quite interesting approach. More advanced books. There is Eric Sparson's Relativist Toolkit. It's an excellent book, but it doesn't start from the very beginning. So it's like excellent if you're taking already second course in general relativity. There is Thomas Ortin's book, Gravity and Strings. Gravitational part is super nice. The stringy part is too concise. So you cannot really learn much from, I think. Anyway, and then there is Relativist Bible by Bob Wald, General Relativity. It's also very concise, but very, very good book. So anyway, requirements to pass the course is you have to attend the tutorials, and you have to submit 3 homeworks on time, and then you have to pass the interview. Okay, so are there any questions so far? All right. So this is, by the way, this is the how the PSI study text looks like, and it's about 100 pages long, and it should have everything you need to know about in this course. All right, so let me start with chapter number 1, which is the overview of special relativity. And because you are supposed to know everything already, I will go a little bit fast, but I will also try to emphasize the main differences. Okay, and so what is really different in special relativity and in Newtonian physics is actually not that one is invariant with respect to Galilean transformations and the other one with respect to the Lorentz transformations, but it's really the causal structure of the space-time. Okay, so part A is causal structure. And okay, so what is a space-time? So space-time for us at this point is just a continuum of space-time events. So it's a continuum of space-time events. So an event, basically you can think about an event like a point in the space-time. So it's a point in space in a given instant of time. So space-time is a continuum of these space-time events. And again, we take it to be really a continuous smooth thing, although it may not be so in real life. So now what is interesting is that you can basically classify these events. So given 2 events, I can consider 3 distinct possibilities. So either the one event is to the future, to the other one, or it's to the past, or actually they can never talk to each other. So these are 3 distinct possibilities, and basically based on how these possibilities are treated, we can understand the differences between Newtonian and special relativity physics. Okay, so we have 3 mutually distinct possibilities. So if you have point Q, so I have an observer, which is my point P. So that's, you can think about that as an observer. And then the first possibility is that you can actually go from P to Q. So an observer can go from an event, space-time event P, to event Q. So that's first possibility. And then you say that Q, and so what I really mean by observer here is either a massive particle or somebody who is like physical. So it's not a tachyonic particle, or it's not a light-like particle. I'm really talking about a massive normal observer here. So if observer can go from P to Q, then you say that Q is to the future. To the future of P. Future of P. The other possibility is that it's precisely the other way around. So I have P, but I can go from Q to P. So if possible to go from Q to P, then you say that Q is to the past. Past of P. And third option is that it's never possible to actually go from, you know, Q to P or whatever. So third distinct possibility is that it's impossible impossible. For the observer, to basically observe both events, P and Q, to be at both events, P and Q. In other words, if the observer is at a point P, it can never see what's happening at Q. Okay, and so these are the three distinct possibilities which we can have for the events in the space-time. Okay, and so based on how these three possibilities actually look like, we can distinguish Newtonian physics, and we can distinguish the special relativity physics. Okay, so in Newtonian physics, basically, the events of the space-time which belong to number three form a three-dimensional surface, which is called a surface of simultaneity. Okay, so I will be drawing diagrams where I will be going in time in this direction and space in that direction. And then in Newtonian physics, what simply happens is that this is your point P, and then the events which belong to this third class, where it is impossible to go to Q, are simply in this 3D surface. So this is the option number three. And so we have a 3D simultaneity surface. Okay, so that's how this subset of events looks like. It's just a 3D surface in the 4D space-time. And of course, the events which are to the future are here, and the events which are to the past are below this. So as the time goes here, so past is here. But you know, no matter how the point Q is, you know, far, far, far away, if it's to the past, I can still reach it. Well, how far away is here, I can still reach it by an observer. Okay, so that's because you have basically instantaneous propagation. All right, so that's the Newtonian physics. In relativity, this is much more restricted. And so this looks very, very different. So in relativity, so special relativity, you know that the basic building block is the light cone, right? So now I have a light cone. So this is my point P of the observer. And then if you want to go to the future, so light cone like that, then you can only, you know, only points which lie within the light cone are actually to the future. So if you are inside this, then this is the future. If you are past to P in the past light cone, this is the past. So this is, which one is? Well, okay, so this is one, this is two, and now the subset of region three is much, much bigger. Okay, so this is the region three here. I cannot reach anywhere outside of the light cone. And so this is now much, much bigger. It's a 4D subset. So before, it was the 3D simultaneity surface. But now I have 4D subset of events, which belong to 2.3. OK, and so these are called the events which belong, you know, here with respect to P are called space-like separated events, space-like separated. Separated, and this is really a 4D region, or 4D set. whereas that one was 3D. This is 4D. So the structure is, you know, very, very different. And it's much more restrictive in the sense that, you know, region number three here was basically zero measure subset, right? It was just a surface, whereas here is the 4D region. Okay. So, of course, this is the light cone. And, you know, anything only which lies within that light cone actually is to the future, or anything is to the past. All right, so that's special relativity. Everybody's seen this. Everybody's seen light cones. Okay, perfect. So that's how it looks in special relativity. So interestingly, light cone structure is also very important in general relativity. So let's have a remark. Remark. Light cone structure. Is also important in general relativity. So once we include gravitational fields, but it's only locally, What it means is that basically, as you go from space-time point to a space-time point, space-time event, actually the light cones can sort of twist around. Okay, so light cones can twist around. But locally, they are still the same light cones. Okay. So what I mean by that, so let's have a nice example of a black hole space-time. So let's plot, okay. So this is my radial coordinate. And so r goes from 0 to infinity. So let's say the black hole is located at r equal to 0. And then there is an important radius called whatever, the radius of the black hole. So there will be some r equal to r plus, which is given by the mass of the black hole. So if you have m is the mass of the black hole, then there will be an important radius r plus, which is 2m. And that's an important radius. But something strange really happens. So what happens is that if you are very, very far away from the black hole, the light cone simply looks like you would be used to. It's just pointing up. And, you know, of course, I travel within the light cone, so I have to be, you know, inside like that. But as I go closer to that radius, r equal to r plus, the light cone actually starts twisting towards the black hole. So it's a little bit twisted here. And it's very much twisted on this radius r equal to r plus. So in that case, it looks like this. Not like that.
It's vertical.
That's not good. Like that. So this is a vertical line. Thank you for much. And so what it means is if I want to travel to the future of the light cone, so I have to travel this way. So actually, no matter what I do, I cannot get away from the black hole. Actually, my radius either stays r equal to r plus, if I am actually traveling at the speed of light, if I am on the light cone, or actually has to go inside. Okay, so basically there's this special radius that every massive particle, if I get into that radius, I have to just travel, you know, towards r equal to zero of that black hole. And so if you go even below that, then it looks like this. And so you just have to go here. And at r equal to 0, there will be a singularity according to standard general relativity. And that will eventually crush you. So you can happily decide to go, you know, inside the black hole. You can probe its vicinity, but better stay above r equal to 2m, because if you actually go below r equal to 2m, then you will be eventually crushed at r equal to 0. But you see nicely the twisting of the light cone. So locally, you still have basically special relativity, but globally, this is no longer true. And so I have this twisting, and so in the end, you know, I twisted the light cone. I have to go this way. Okay, so now this is interesting. So now you might be thinking, well, could I actually make, you know, my light cones to twist in such a way that actually I form a closed time light curve? Okay, so in other words, can I actually twist it in the way that even if I, in each local light cone, I travel to the future, I actually come to my own past? And in fact, you can. So beware. We have solutions, general relativity with closed time-like curves. Closed time-like curves. Or CTCs, closed time-like curves. And so in such an example, you would have a light cone, local light cone here, and then later on this will be twisted the other way around, and then I have a light cone like that, and then I have a light cone like that, and so I travel to the future, and I travel to the future, and I travel to the future, and I come where I started. Okay, so such spacetimes actually are possible, and people consider them pathological, but maybe they are not so pathological as people think, because an example of such spacetime where this actually happens is the Kerr black hole spacetime, which is a rotating, the only spacetime describing rotating black hole. So for example, Kerr spacetime which is the only solution in general relativity for rotating black hole. There is no any other solution. Okay? Only rotating black hole solution. So, you know, if you want to find a solution for rotating black hole, it must be Kerr. But actually, Kerr solution is plagued with these closed time-like curves. What saves you is that, yes, just a second, that these closed time-like curves are actually underneath the horizon. They are close to the singularity, close to r equal to 0, basically. And so they are not accessible to an observer from outside of the black hole. Okay, that saves the day. So people think, you know, this is still fine because they are hiding behind the horizon. Okay, so this is, you know, hiding from an observer standing outside of the black hole behind the horizon. So behind the surface r equal to 2m, if it were approximately rotating, slowly rotating. Was there a question?
I was just gonna ask, no, like that solves it. I was just gonna ask, if we have closed time-like curves, we cannot have Cauchy surfaces, right? So what does it mean to solve the differential equation? What does it mean if you don't?
Of course, this you obtain as an analytical extension of things, right? So you solve. Well done. Okay. Okay. Let's leave it there. All right. So this is one example of a spacetime, but fortunately here it's hiding behind the horizon. Okay. There is another interesting spacetime, which is actually it's called Taub-Knott spacetime. Taub-Knott spacetime. And so that's basically a spacetime if you had a rotating string. So let's say I have a rotating string, infinitely long, rotating string. Okay, so then you can show that if the string is infinitely thin, that as you go closer and closer to the string, the angle of variable phi now becomes time-like. But phi is closed. So actually, you could imagine that I have the rotating string here, and you know this goes around it. So this is by phi angle. So this will be the string which rotates in this way. And then you would have cos time-like curves in this Taub-Knot solution. So this would be not hiding behind the horizon. There is also a horizon, but it's not important for us. Well, for the string itself, there is no horizon. So then you would have this thing here. And then people debate, is this actually physical or not physical? People doing ADS CFT would say it's not physical because this goes all the way to the boundary. We don't know how to do CFT with closed time-like curves. But anyway, so Taub-Knot is a solution, basically like a black hole solution with rotating strings, and there the closed time-like curve is not hiding behind the horizon. So is this physical? Is this pathological or physical? And people mostly say it's pathological, but maybe it's not. And certainly it's a prediction of general relativity. The solution exists, and it's nice, and whatever.
Can you explain this a bit further? Like, are you talking about like an ordinary string in like flat space-time? Like
maybe we'll talk about Taub-Knot a little bit later, but basically... Yeah, you can think about it like, really, I have a cosmic string, like a string, delta-like source on the axis, okay, and then I provide some angular momentum to this string. That's precisely what it is. So now you can have a black hole, which is in the middle, and then you have a string, which sort of provides an angular momentum to this black hole. And so it will be like a rotating space-time as well, similar to curved space-time. It's also a vacuum solution, apart from the string. Okay, but it has, you know, closed time like curves around that string. I'll talk about it later.
I have heard that people say that you cannot travel in time because it violates causality.
So what happens is, right? Yeah, so I do some action here. I kill my grandfather, and then you know I come here, and the grandfather doesn't exist, so I couldn't be born here, right? So you are really violating causality here, right? So that's precisely what's happening here. So anyway, so this is just a remark, okay?
Thankfully, this is behind the horizon, so.
Well, sometimes it is not. All right, so you know, just let me stress. So the causal structure is really the key difference which distinguishes Newtonian physics from the physics of special relativity, and it's because the causal structure of the space-time is very, very different. Here, I have just 3D surfaces of simultaneity, and here, I have space-like events. And the space-like events, you know, much, much bigger region. That's why special relativity is much more restrictive. It tells you, you know, what you can do and what you cannot do in the space-time, much more restrictive than this one here. The same remains true in general relativity locally, okay? But globally, it may not be true, and then you can have problems like this. All right, so... Any more questions to this? All right, so now let me discuss. It's not really about causal structure, but let me just say a few words. So both in special relativity and in Newtonian physics, there is an important concept, that of the inertial observer. So inertial observers, play important role in both Newtonian and special relativistic physics. Okay, so this is basically what the two types of physics actually share in common. So they have very, very different space-time structure, but they share the thing is that actually the inertial observers are some distinguished observers. And so how you actually find these observers, you know, distinguishes special relativity from Newtonian physics, but it's basically, you know, just a tiny tune-up of things. So What I mean by inertial observers is, you know, these are special preferred observers, typically for which the equations of motion take a simplified form. Okay, so take, for example, Newtonian physics. So you have the first law, and then you have the second law. First law tells you if there is no force, acceleration is zero. Okay, second law tells you if there is a force, acceleration is F equal to ma. Okay, so now, of course, this doesn't make any sense, because the first law follows immediately from the second law. Right? If I have no force, then acceleration is zero. So the first law follows from the second law. Okay, so there's something wrong with this formulation of Newtonian physics. Of course, what's wrong with this formulation is that the first law is not formulated properly. So what, how it should be properly formulated is that you say, well, actually, there exists a special observer, an inertial observer, an inertial frame, for which, you know, the equations of motion take a simple form. Okay, so that's the first law. It's about the existence of the inertial frame. Then you have the second law, which tells you, well, in this frame, in this preferred inertial frame, my fourth law looks extremely simple. It's just F equal to ma. Okay, so that's the true content of the two laws. Of course, there is a caveat, and that is in that if you have one inertial observer, then you actually have infinitely many inertial observers. They are connected by Galilean transformations or Poincaré transformations in special relativity. Okay, so that's you know, inertial observers. If you have one where the equations of motions are simple, then you have infinitely many of them. So in fact, we have in both types of physics infinitely many of inertial observers. And these are connected by, and in one case, and it's really a small tune-up in Newtonian physics, is the Galilean transformations, and in the other case is the Poincaré transformations. So tiny tune up. Of course, what I mean by Galilean transformations is just rotations, space translations, and Galilean boosts. Here, I mean boosts, space rotations, and space-time translations. Okay, so we have in these Poincaré transformations, you'll have boosts. Everybody heard the name boost? Okay, it's basically like a special Lorentz transformation. So let me just write it down. Space rotations, of course, everybody has done spatial rotations and space-time translations. I can not only translate in space, but I can also translate in time. So let's take an example of the boost. And so boost, so example, it's the boost in x direction. And so you basically go from one coordinate system, which is the preferred and inertial one, to another one by doing t prime equals to gamma times t minus vx over c square, and then x prime equals to gamma x minus vt. And here gamma is just 1 over 1 minus beta square, and beta is just a shortcut for the velocity divided by the speed of light. So that would be an example of a Poincaré transformation, example of the boost in the x direction. So now you notice that there is this important constant c, which we already discussed in the previous course. It's the speed of light predicted by the Maxwell's theory. So this basically goes back to 1860. Okay. But what is actually important about this boost in x direction is that now you realize that you can sort of think about, even in the special relativity, about 3D surfaces of simultaneity, but they are not the same for all the for all observers. Okay, so what this thing is actually doing is that it twists the axis x and t. So if I start this one observer, which is the initial observer, and I have axis like this, I have t, and I have x, and that's for the observer, one initial observer here. Well, this is our observer O, and he's using this axis. So then what this transformation does is that it actually, you know, tilts this axis toward 45 degrees. So if this is 45, then the new t prime will be here. And then symmetrically, the new x prime will be there. And that's the O prime observer axis. And so if you want, the 3D surface of simultaneity for the observer O is the one where he says t equals to 0. So then the 3D surface will be this 3D hypersurface here. On the other hand, for the observer O prime, the surface of simultaneity will be such that t prime is equal to 0, which is this one here. Okay. For a different observer, moving even faster, where v goes even faster, it will be more tilted toward 45 degrees. And if you are actually moving at v equal to c, it will be exactly this one here, it'll be just a light cone. So what you can think about these, you know, space-like separated events, is like I can slice this 4D subset of my space-time into surfaces of simultaneity for different observers, right? So I will have. So I will have one surface of simultaneity like this, but then there will be another observer for whom it will be like that. Well, not like that, almost like that. Let's say like that, and so on. Okay, so I can actually basically fill up these space-like separated events with surfaces of simultaneity for different observers. So this is the surface of simultaneity for O prime. This is the surface of simultaneity for O. And then if you want, if I consider all possible observers moving in all possible, you know, velocities smaller than c, then I actually fill the whole thing here. If I move the other direction, probably this way. Okay, so of course, you know, this interesting feature of the Lorentzian boosts is basically the source of all confusion about special relativity. And so that's why people still struggle and come with some different, you know, paradoxes and stuff like that, because they don't really understand that you can have different surfaces of simultaneity. So basically it doesn't mean anything to say, you know, now at Alpha Centauri something happened. Okay, that doesn't mean anything, because that may be true very well for you, but it will not be true for a different observer. That observer will have different simultaneity surface. Okay. Questions? Everything is easy peasy. That's good. So now let me finally mention, you know, what is absolute and what is not absolute. So what you can actually measure if you have, you know, space-time structures like this. So in principle, each observer or initial observer, they can use their coordinates, but how do they actually agree on some predictions? And so in general, coordinates have no intrinsic meaning. Coordinates have
intrinsic meaning. And that's already true in special relativity, and in general relativity even more. And so we need to search for quantities which do have, search for absolute quantities, for quantities T's with absolute meaning. It will be different because the space-time causal structure is different. So in Newtonian physics, for Newton, you will have two such quantities composed just of the coordinates. And so one of them is the absolute time. So if you have one, you know, event at one absolute time, and then later you have some other event, then every observer will agree that there elapsed some absolute time between the two things. So that will be delta t, because we have absolute time, and then, of course, they will also agree on the distance between the two points, but only in the same simultaneity surface. So if you fix t, then they will agree the distance between the two points is this. Okay, but if you consider the events which are also separated in time, they will never agree because I have Galilean boosts. And if I have Galilean boosts, actually they will change the meaning of the distance. So it's delta x for simultaneous events. So in Newtonian physics, because of that causal structure of space-time, you have actually two quantities which you can consider, and everybody will agree on them, and it's the difference between the absolute times, and it's the distance in the simultaneous surface. On the other hand, in special relativity, there's only one, and that's the space-time interval. Space-time interval, and what I mean by that is that now delta S squared, that's the space-time interval, you can write it in a fancy way in terms of the Minkowski metric, eta mu nu, delta x mu, delta x nu, which is nothing else than minus c square delta t square plus delta ij delta xi delta xj. And so this is the only all the observers will agree on if you have a causal structure like that. And of course the Minkowski metric eta mu nu is just plus one minus one minus one. I was already stressing in the previous courses I'm taking the signature to be minus, plus, plus, plus. Okay, so this is the Minkowski metric, which is minus 1, plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, diagonal metric. And these are the space-time events, so you take VCT and xi, and c is the velocity of i. Okay, so that's the only thing people will agree on in special relativity. So now this Minkowski metric looks super nice. I said it's almost zero everywhere, but the diagonal is minus one, plus one, plus one, plus one. So now you can consider special transformations which leave this metric invariant. They will be precise to the Poincaré transformations, which actually connect these initial observers. Okay? Before we go there, are there any questions? Everything is super nice and super easy. So just remember, really, that picture is the most important thing about Newton versus special relativity. And you will remember that because it will be one of your interview questions. Okay. So now basically there will be, I don't know, 18 questions, so you already know answer to one of them. Questions?
The fact that the interval is constant, is it something that we get from the fact that we take the speed of light to be constant? So like that is something we get by definition as a result of that.
So yeah, so I'm taking speed of light to be constant. And if you want, this is also like a special relativity, but it comes from this constant. All right, so part B, Lorentz transformations. I just want to show you some nice pictures. You've probably seen this already, but let's just do it very quickly. So part B is the Lorentz transformations. So basically, transformations that they leave the Minkowski metric form of the Minkowski metric invariant. The form of Minkowski metric, or invariant. Or you could say that they leave, you know, that space-time interval invariant. And so you consider a transformation that I have new coordinates related to the old ones by a constant matrix, lambda mu nu. Well, this lambda mu nu has to satisfy something so that is true, that the space-time interval is invariant. And so that something actually is the condition for this be a Lorentz transformation, and it's just lambda mu alpha, lambda nu beta, beta mu nu. So this is the definition, if you want, of a Lorentz transformation. So this thing here. And of course, this is not only Lorentz boosts, but it's rotations as well. And it's, well, okay, translations, but anyway, rotations as well. But in principle, you could also consider things like I change time to minus time. That will certainly leave my space-time interval invariant. And so that will also be a Lorentz transformation by its definition. Now, also that this is basically like, okay, if I, so eta alpha beta is almost one, right? It differs from one by having a minus one in the first thing. Otherwise, it's a unit matrix, okay? And so basically what this is telling you is that this is something like one equals to lambda transpose lambda t1, except the one is now replaced with an eta. But if you had a relation one equals to lambda t lambda, it's just a definition of rotational matrices. So basically what it's telling you, this thing here, is basically you should be thinking about Lorentz transformations as rotations, but now not only in space, but now I live in space-time. So it's like rotations in space-time. Okay, so it's rotations in space-time. All right, so now your matrix lambda, of course, better be non-degenerate. Otherwise, this is really screwed up. And if it's non-degenerate, you can invert it. And so you can define, as we did previously, you can define lambda tilde, which would be the inverse transformation. So the inverse transformation would be that x mu is lambda tilde mu nu x prime nu. And this is just an inverse transformation to that one, inverse matrix. So you would have lambda mu nu, lambda tilde nu alpha, delta mu alpha. Okay, so that will be the inverse transformation. And then why is this inverse transformation useful? Is that now you can define vectors and covectors according to whether they transform in this matrix or whether they transform in that matrix. Okay, so then you have a vector, simply an object for us in special relativity, whose components transform with the help of this thing here. So then you have v mu prime is lambda mu nu v nu. That's how they transform. So they transform with this matrix lambda. And then you have a covector, which will have an index down, omega mu prime, and that transforms according to this guy here. So it's lambda tilde nu mu omega nu. And then you have a scalar, which does not transform. So basically, so what I mean by this is I'm changing coordinates from x to x prime, and the change of these coordinates, my components of the object transform in this way. But of course, in principle, the components of the vector could depend on the space-time coordinates, so on x. So what I mean here is that this is v of x, whereas this is v prime mu of x prime, okay? But scalar simply does not transform, and so it means that phi of x prime is just phi of x. Okay, so that's, that doesn't change. So it's basically one component which does not change under these kind of transformations. And then you can have tensors, and so tensors basically transform as a product of that many vectors and that many covectors. Okay. Have I seen this in the previous course? All right. So now, of course, examples of these types of transformations are, as I said, rotations. So I don't need to write down the rotation matrix. Rotation matrix, let's say I rotate in the xy plane. It's just I do a cosine theta and sine theta applied on my coordinates and everything. So my matrix lambda will be zero everywhere apart from the xy plane. And there I will have cosine theta and sine theta, cosine theta, sine theta. Okay, so that's trivial. But let's do the boost, which we have already formula over there. So an example of this thing would be, again, the boost. But let me just write it in the x direction. Just let me just write it not in terms of v and c, but in terms of, like, I want this to look like a rotation. But the only difference is now that I'm rotating in space and time. But the time has different signature. The time has the minus sign. So what will actually happen is that wherever I saw before cosine theta, I will say now, I will now see cosine h theta. So that's the, okay. So then we have lambda alpha beta on the boost. And so I'll have time component here, and then I'll have x, y, and z, x, y, and z. And so now I'm rotating in the time and x direction. And so instead of cosine theta, I will have cosine h theta, and then minus sine h theta, and then 0, 0. I'm not doing anything in y and z directions. And then here it would be exactly the same. So it's minus sine h theta, cosine h theta. And then I'm not doing anything here. This is just unity. 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Like that. So that's boost in x direction, but I'm just making obvious that this is like a rotation, but now rotation is space-time. And of course, you can translate that back into your favorite formula in terms of V and C. So now we can translate that thing into this thing here, provided that we say what this data is and how, you know, we relate it to B. And so this is done in the following way. So we have the beta equals to V over C, but we say this is actually tangent H of beta. And if you do that, you find that cosine H theta, so from this it follows that cosine H theta is just V gamma factor, and sine H theta is just beta gamma. Okay, so I just make this identification, I relate theta angle rotation in the space-time to my velocity v, and then this will be true, and of course then this matrix and apply on x, on t and x will give you t prime and x prime as given in that form. Okay, so and we have agreement with that thing. So now it's obvious that this transformation leaves the space-time interval invariant because this is just a rotation. Questions? So now let me just stress that one can actually, so the defining property of Lorentz transformations is that it leaves the space-time interval invariant. Okay. So now it's very useful to plot these space-time intervals, how they look like in the space-time diagram. And why is it useful is that we can immediately understand what is the Lorentz contraction and what is the dilatation of time. Okay, so, and again, you know everything. All right, so let me just display, so I just stress that we have the Lorentz invariant space-time interval. And how it looks like, so let me just put it in the TX plane, is that you have the t here, and you have x here, and then you have these important 45 degree light cones. So then, you may be asking, how does this delta S square looks like? So in our case, it's just minus c square t square plus x square. So how does it look like if delta S square is actually positive, zero, or negative? So of course zero means that minus c square t square equals to plus x square equals to zero. So ct equals to x. So this is precisely the line of delta S square equal to zero. So this line x equal to ct, x equal to ct precisely corresponds to delta S square equal to zero, or delta S equal to zero. And then if you want that you travel more in space than in time, so if delta S is actually positive and equal to a constant, then you would get this thing here. So this would be delta S bigger than zero, delta S square bigger than zero. Delta S square equal to a constant, which is bigger than zero. And then if you wanted a negative one, you would have something like this. So this would be delta S square equals to constant, but now negative. Okay, so this is how they look like. And that's clear. So now let's just use this to understand two amazing phenomena, which is the time dilatation and lattice contraction. Okay, so let's do the time dilatation first. So time dilatation. And so the simplest way how to use this for understanding time dilatation is that you say, well, I have two observers. One observer is moving with some velocity with respect to the other. Let the observer who is not moving carry clock. Let this clock, you know, stands there with the observer, and it just ticks in some time interval t. Okay, so we have an observer O, which has a clock. And this clock is not moving anywhere, it just ticks. Okay, so there will be a tick at t equal to zero. There will be a tick at some t equal to capital T. There will be a tick in 2t. There will be a tick in 3t, and so on. So that's our clock, which the observer O carries with himself. Okay? So now we have a different observer who's moving with respect to the observer O. Okay, so the axis of that observer are tilted. So now we have T prime and X prime. Okay, so how does this observer see the clock? Okay, of course, he's looking at his simultaneously surfaces. Okay, so now I'm taking t prime equal to constant. So how do I find t prime equal to constant? Is that I draw parallels with my x prime axis. So this will be t prime, follow v1 thing, there will be another thing, and so these are parallel to that thing. I should be equally separated, they are not. But anyway, so this is when I see, when this observer O prime sees this clock to clock, to tick. So he sees it here, sees it here, sees it here, and so on. Okay, so what this observer O prime sees is the period, this one here, is the T prime period. So now the question, worth $1 million, is capital T prime bigger or smaller than capital T? So T prime, how does T prime relate to T? Okay, and so naively, if you just look at the diagram, you see that the T prime is bigger than T. Okay, but this is super misleading, right? Because you are in space-time diagram, nothing is as obvious as it should be. So what you really have to do is that you have to compare with respect to the space-time interval. So that's the only thing which is observable and measurable. Okay, so now you want to plot, you know, what are the... So this is a space-time interval to that click. So what are the exactly equal space-time points, well, with the same space-time interval? Well, they form this hyperbola here. Okay, so then I have to plot this hyperbola like that. And so all points on this hyperbola will have the same space-time interval, namely minus c capital T squared. Okay, so then what it means is that I can go on this line here. So, well, maybe I need color. The only time ever I'm going to use color. It's the same as white, okay. Green. So this thing here is the same as that thing there. That's the space-time interval is the same. Because we live on the same hyperbola. But the capital T prime is actually bigger by this piece. Okay, so what we conclude immediately is that T prime is actually bigger than T, just from this diagram. Okay, so what that means is that actually, for a moving observer, times go more slowly. So moving observer for moving observer. Time goes more slowly. So there'll be several advices in this course for you guys. So the first one here is, if you want to stay young and beautiful, just you better keep moving. Because then your time, and of course you can do also many more things, right? So this is very, very important that you start moving, okay? So that's immediately the conclusion here. Of course, you know, you can do the math here, and you can just use the transformation here. And so what you are doing is that, because x stays constant for the clock, so x is not moving, so x is actually zero, and then we see that t prime is gamma times t. Okay, so this is the conclusion, t primes is gamma times t, just from the transformation. That's super simple to see from the transformation, because x is equal to zero. But it's much nicer to actually plot the diagram here. And so in this case, we saw that this piece is actually bigger than that piece, and so it was actually true even in this weird space-time geometry diagram. That's really capital T prime was bigger than T. So now let's do the Lorentz contraction, where this will be precisely opposite. Okay, are there any questions to time dilatation? Okay, so let's do the Lorentz contraction. And so in this case, we have again the observer O, which measures T and X. And let's see this, let's say that this observer carries a rod of the length L. Okay, so now in this frame, the rod extends to some length L. And let's plot the trajectory, space-time trajectory of this rod. The rod is not moving anywhere. So one endpoint always ends at x equal to zero, the other one ends at x equal to L. Okay, so this is the trajectory of my rod. Should be the straight line. All right. So this is my rod like that. Now there'll be so many lines that it will not make any sense. So now let's consider the observer who actually is moving with respect to O. So again, I have T prime, and then I have X prime. So the first observer. Yes?
The two T prime is a straight line, right?
Yeah. So sorry, which one? No, this is a straight line, of course.
Straight line.
No, it's supposed to be straight line. It doesn't look like. It looks like a maybe parabola. Okay, that is a straight line. All right, very good. So one observer measures this length of the rod as the observer O. Okay, this is the observer O. On the other hand, the other observer measures at his T prime equal to zero. So he measures this stick here, the green thing. So he measures this distance, and that's L prime. Okay, all the way up here. Okay, so now it seems that L prime is bigger than L. Okay, in this but don't be mistaken, you have, you know, strange geometry. So let me draw another straight line, which is the 45 degree line. Okay, so almost straight. So that's the 45 degree. So remember again the space-time points, which have the space-time interval equal to plus L square, are those on the hyperbola. Okay, so these are the points which have, you know, all the points from the origin have the space-time interval equal to L square. Okay, So actually, what L corresponds to is actually this distance. So this is L. And so it's obvious that L is actually bigger than L prime. So L is bigger than L prime. And so what it means is that actually the distances, if you're moving, actually get contracted. So that's, you know, distances contract. And it's simple exercise to show that, again, I can use the transformation, you know, for the setup here, and you will find that L prime is actually L divided by gamma. Okay, just use it, do it this way. But again, the picture is so much nicer, right? So I just see, you know, this L, I see this L prime here, but actually if I want to know what is the actual space-time interval, it goes on the hyperbola, and so then L is actually bigger than L prime. And that's how you derive Lorentz contraction. All right, so as I said, there are many paradoxes which basically can be attributed to the weird geometry of space-time, or to this minor sign, and the fact that the space-time interval is invariant, not the spatial one. And so you will discuss in your tutorial the paradox of twins, which is a lot of fun. Of course, that, so it's a famous paradox. We have two twins, one stays on the Earth, the other one travels to Alpha Centauri and then comes back. And then the question is, which one is older? And of course, you know, from the perspective of this observer, this one travels, so it actually should age more slowly. But from the perspective of the other observer, the one on the Earth actually goes away and comes back to him or her. So then, you know, the question is, you know, what is really the resolution of this paradox? And you cannot really resolve it within special relativity. You need general relativity to resolve this paradox, but you can sort of formulate it in a special relativistic setting. And that's what you will do in your tutorial. And then you will show that actually there is one unique prediction, which one is older, and you may be guessing which one. And that certainly will be one who is actually older. Okay. So anyway, so are there any questions to Lorentz transformations? So there are no paradoxes in special relativity. Everything can be explained. It is quite interesting is that, you know, if you're a scientist, you tend to receive lots of emails from various people. And it's mostly like, I have disproved, you know, relativity or whatever. But they always only disprove special relativity. Nobody disproves the general relativity. Because, you know, people, they think they understand special relativity. but nobody actually attempts really to understand general relativity. So you get lots of, you know, paradoxes resolved, but only about special relativity. All right. So the last thing I want to discuss about in special relativity are the relativistic objects. And of course, the simplest one is the relativistic particle, which we already sort of discussed. I'll be again super fast. So part C of this overview of special relativity will be relativistic objects. And so let me start with a particle. And again, you have seen this picture, so I apologize. So a particle sweeps the whole line in the space-time. So we have ct, and we have x. And simply, a particle, as it moves, it sweeps this thing here, which I can parameterize as x mu r function of some parameter lambda, and this is called the world line trajectory. And then you can consider its falsity with respect to the parameter lambda, which will be just the dx over the lambda is the velocity, for velocity. And as I was telling you last time, you can distinguish what the magnitude of the four velocity is. It can be either positive, zero, or negative. And so if you write the magnitude, a mu nu dx mu d lambda dx mu d lambda, you have either it's positive, or it's zero, or it's negative. So if it's positive, this is believed to be non-physical, perhaps non-physical, because in the diagram which I deleted, you will be traveling through the space like things. If it's zero, that's called null trajectory, null, and that's how the light travels. Well, not really. So, of course, light is electromagnetic radiation, and electromagnetic radiation, well, propagates according to Maxwell equations. So only in the, you know, if you want to describe light in some geometric optics approximation, then you can say it sort of follows some trajectories into space-time, and then you can sort of describe it as a massless particle, whatever. So you have zero. On the other hand, if you have smaller than zero, that's half the massive particles. Massive particles move, and or the physical observers, how they move. And so I have that eta mu nu dx mu dx nu is actually smaller than zero. And you can change the parameter to nicer parameter so that you can normalize this to negative number to be minus one, and then you have proper time. Proper time for massive particles, tau is simply that eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d, sorry, d tau equals to minus one. So you basically can go for an arbitrary parameter lambda to some nicer parameter tau, so that this is normalized to be minus one. And so that's all you need to know about particles. Of course, now the particles move in the space-time either freely or according to some force. So if they move freely, they obey the geodesic equation. They move on straight lines in the space-time. And you can get that from the action which you've already seen. So free particle, the middle one, so a free particle moves on geodesics which are basically the straight lines or whatever thing, and these geodesics can be derived from the action which is minus m0 c square and integral d tau, this proper parameter tau. So what you are saying is that the geodesics are such that they extremize the proper time. Okay. Of course, you can still write it in terms of the parameter lambda. So what does it mean? So d tau is just square root of minus eta mu nu dx mu dx nu. Okay, d tau is just square root of minus eta mu nu dx mu dx nu from the definition. Okay, so now I can divide by, I can parameterize by lambda. D lambda. And I can multiply by lambda, and I haven't done anything. So this is still true. So now I have to write it in this way. So this is minus m0 c square integral minus eta mu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda d lambda. And that's my action written in terms of the arbitrary parameter. So this is the action which actually gives you, you know, how the particle moves. And the meaning of that action is that you want to extremize the proper time. And actually, you want to maximize the proper time because of the strange minus sign. And that's the geometrical meaning of that. So you are basically, the particle will move from this point to that point on the trajectory which maximizes the proper time. So if I went this thing here, it would be smaller proper time. I go that way and whatever. So this is the one. The one which happens actually corresponds to the maximum of proper time.
So it is a maximum of proper time, but it is a minimum then, because it is a geodesic.
So if you see from this definition, so remember, what was the definition of the space-time interval? It was eta mu nu dx mu dx mu, right? So now if I plug this thing here, so you will find that minus d tau square is actually plus ds square. So it's a Lorentz invariant quantity. So this is really a... okay, so what's your question again?
Well, I think that it is a free particle, so it is a geodesic. So you're having the maximum time, proper time, but you're going to have the minimal length?
You're going to have... well, what do you mean by length? So the space-time interval, well, so d tau square is minus ds square. So that.
But I mean, it is a geodesic.
It is a geodesic, yeah.
So it is a maximum for the proper time, but it is a minimum for the length.
yeah, okay. In flat space, yes. But you know, for example, right? So let's say, well, okay, let's not go there. Okay, so that's the motion of the free particle. And so how you get it is that you say this is your Lagrangian, which is a function of x mu and x mu dot and lambda. And then you write down your Euler Lagrange equations as you did in your tutorial. And that gives you the geodesic equations. They give you that u mu du mu over d tau equals to zero, where u mu is just dx mu over d tau. Okay, so this is the definition of the velocity with respect to the proper time, and this is your geodesic equation. You can write this result in a more confusing way. So basically, you can say, well, I differentiate with respect to time tau, but the time tau, well, if the trajectory is uniquely defined in terms of the, well, there is a unique correspondence between tau and the trajectory, I can actually write d over d tau in terms of the chain rule. So I understand now u was a function of x, which is a function of tau. So note that you can write it in a more confusing way. Note that I can write d over d tau as dx nu over d tau d over dx nu, just using the chain rule. But dx nu over d tau is just u nu. So u nu d over dx nu. So we can write your geodesic equation as d, okay. So we have d u mu over d tau. And then I use this bloody thing for the time. So then this will be written as u mu d u mu over d dx nu, or using just the shortcut notation, this is the same as d nu u mu. And sometimes this is not even short enough for people. So they say, what this is really is, well, okay, so I'm differentiating with respect to my coordinates, but in the direction of u. So this is actually a directional derivative in the u direction of u. So you can also write this as du of u mu. And that's, of course, equal to zero. So sometimes people write geodesic equation in such a confusing way. So I am differentiating in the u direction. So this is derivative respect to x nu times u nu. So I'm really differentiating in the direction of u. And so this is that. Why this is interesting is that, of course, then if you go to general relativity, the only thing which you do is that you replace this partial derivative, this is a covariant derivative, and that's the geodesic equation in the space. So in GR, just a warning, you just replace partial derivative with some more general derivative, and this will be your equation, which is the geodesic equation.
That's great, they understood that last part.
Which one?
How do
I, so this is just a notation. Okay, so this is a bloody trick, right?
Yeah.
This is just a notation. But now what you are doing is that you are differentiating. Well, this is a directional derivative, right? So you just, if you have a vector, you just define a directional derivative with respect to that vector, or sometimes people write d over dv or something like that. It's just v mu d over dx mu, right? That's what people do. So it's a directional derivative. I differentiate with respect to x, but now I multiply by the direction of v. Okay, so that's what I'm using here.
Oh my god, I'm so sorry. This seems so trivial. I'm not understanding it. Sorry. I mean, how do you?
Okay, so let's say the vector goes only in the x direction.
Uh-huh.
So what this is doing, you are summing over all these indices, right? So then you would have just vx would be non-trivial thing. Let's say it would be equal to 1. So then this is just a derivative with respect to the x direction, which is precisely the direction of the vector v. If, on the other hand, it points in x and y directions, there'll be a contribution from vx and vy, right? And so I'm precisely differentiating with respect to the direction determined by the vector v.
Yeah, but I mean, in that example, if we have only a non-trivial component in the x direction and the magnitude of v changes along the x direction, then we would have a non-trivial directional derivative of v along v.
You would have, okay, you are making things more complicated. Yeah, sure. V can depend on x, right? It can depend on anything. I'm just saying at that point, it just, you know, it you know, takes a certain direction of the vector v, and I'm differentiating with respect to that. Okay, take it as a definition if you don't like what it means. All right, so that's the geodesic equation. By the way, everybody knows that p mu is the four momentum, u mu. So m0 is the rest mass of the particle, u is the four velocity, p is the four momentum. So I can also write this as d p mu over d tau equals to zero. That's my free motion of the free particle. And then it's obvious how to generalize this. If you have forces, you just put a force on the right-hand side, and that's your Newton's law. So this is a four force, and that's the second Newton's law. Second Newton's law. If you have some non-trivial force. Perfect. So now we understand free particles, and we understand particles that are not so free. Particles are not the only objects which can be relativistic. You can have other objects which are relativistic. For example, strings. Okay, so how a string look like in flat Minkowski space? So now I will only concentrate on the free objects, although you can also formulate, you know, in the presence of forces. So what about the motion of a string? So marginally, people consider P brains, P is a number. Okay, so motion of P brains. So what is a P brain? Is that so P brain? Is a high dimensional object, higher dimensional object, which sweeps a p plus one dimensional trajectory that sweeps p plus one dimensional trajectory in the space time. So according to this definition, what do you think the particle is? So what does a particle sweep in the space time?
Zero brain.
What's this one?
Ah. So So the particle sweeps a one-dimensional trajectory. So this is the particle, right? Particle sweeps a one-dimensional trajectory, a line, okay? And so according to this, it must be a zero brain. Okay. So on the other hand, if you had a string at a given instant of time has some length, which extends to the space. Okay, so if you had a string, then LB one endpoint at a given instead of time, and another endpoint. So this would be how the string looks like at a given, okay, at a given instant of time. And then, of course, these endpoints, they evolve in time, and so everything in between evolves in time. So then this thing will sweep something here, and that's a trajectory the string sweeps in the space-time. So whereas here we call it word line, because it was actually a line, word line. So here it's really a sheet, so that's why it's called word sheet. Okay, word sheet. And string is simply, it sweeps a two-dimensional word sheet in the space-time, so it's a one trip. But then you can go higher, right? I just cannot plot it, but you can go to a two-brain, which will sweep a three-dimensional trajectory in the space-time. All right. So now you may be thinking, okay, so I understand the particle. I understand the particle moves in such a way that actually the proper time, all the length, is extremize. Okay, extremizes. Length. Well, that's the action that extremizes over time, the length. So here, the idea is that maybe the string actually moves in such a way that the word shield has actually an extreme surface. So extremizes word shield volume. So action, so extremizes word shield volume. In our case, the volume is just a 2D surface, so we want to actually extremize this, the size of this two surface. Okay. All right, so now how do we do that? So by the way, so here we just parameterize the trajectory as x mu of lambda. Okay, so it was basically how the space-time coordinates look like in terms of one parameter lambda, in terms of the time on the watch. Okay, so now, of course, we have a sheet, we have a two-dimensional thing, we will need to have two parameters which live on that sheet. So let's say the one according to which these things evolve is still the lambda parameter, but then I also have another parameter which goes along, which tells me, you know, where on the string I am. So let's call it parameter sigma. So now the worksheet is actually parameterized by two parameters, lambda and sigma. And so more generally, you know, this worksheet, worksheet for a pea brain will simply be described by saying, well, my space-time coordinates are a function of several parameters where this A index goes from 0 to P. So in the case of string, so a particle, we just have xi A equals to lambda. And for the string, we have xi A. Now you have to have two parameters, so it's lambda and sigma. And then if you have, you know, higher dimensional objects, you would have more parameters, which actually tells you, you know, where on the sheet I am. Okay.
And the length of the string change as well?
Yeah, in principle. Okay. So this is called an embedding of, you know, of the worksheet into the spacetime. So you have to know, if you know how this actually things look like, then you know how the string moves in the space. Okay. Yes.
So in such embeddings, if I choose like a, like for fix theta, I have like the motion of a particle, right? If I fix theta, that means I fix somewhere in the string, and then
okay.
I have the motion of a particle, right?
I don't have any eta sigma, but okay.
Yeah, sigma. That's and so if I do that, can I choose a parameter and embedding of the string such that the motion of that particle would be superluminal?
Sure, I think you can. Because what it really doesn't make sense to distinguish points on the string. So yeah. You can find by reparametrizing these things, you could actually move one point in the string to another point in the string, which would move faster than the speed of light. But actually not physical really. Okay. So anyway, so this is how we want to describe the higher dimensional objects. We just know how space-time coordinates look like as a function of several parameters. And we have that many parameters as the worksheet, as is the dimension of the object. So now, because we know how to extremize this thing here, so the action for a free particle was just an integral over d tau. So we now want to calculate the volume of this worksheet and extremize that volume. Okay, so motion of free P brain simply extremizes P brain's warp volume. The warp volume. Okay, and so you need to know how to calculate the volume of this thing here. I just give you the answer. It's easy to convince yourself that it's true. But anyway, so now the type of action here is called Nambu-Goto action. And so as Nambu-Goto, so now the strings, they have some tension, or the p-brains, there will be a tension, which is just a constant. And then there'll be an integral over minus determinant of some matrix gamma AB d p plus 1 of xi. Okay, so that's the action. And of course, what stands here is just the volume of the worksheet. And so what is this volume of the worksheet? Is that first, you have to actually look at what the geometry on the worksheet is, as dictated by the space-time metric. Okay. And I have 5 minutes, so that's enough. So,
we're 10 minutes over, class. It was
oh, are we?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry for that. Let me just write this. I'm so sorry. Oh, sorry. Very good. So I'll just give you the answer. So this gamma AB is called induced metric. And what it is that you take the coordinates, so you need to know what this x mu of psi a is, and you just differentiate the x mu over this d psi a, and then you take another one, x nu, d psi b, and then eta mu nu. Okay, so this is your induced metric. Of course, in case of the particle, you have just one xi, which is lambda. So you have dx over d lambda, dx over d lambda, and that better reduces to that action there. Okay, so this is how you calculate the induced metric. You take the determinant of that metric, that gives you the volume, and you just calculate that volume and you extremize the volume, and that's how the motion of the free objects is actually in space-time. Okay, so let me finish here. You will study the Polyakov action in your tutorial, so I don't need to discuss it here anyway. So there you go. Sorry for that.